Mattis rallied all of his courage, took a deep breath, and charged the Gorgon. He didn't think he'd actually do her any harm, but maybe he would succeed in not embarrassing himself completely. As he ran, Imos swung at him. Through some dumb instinct, Mattis ducked and found himself in her very close personal radius. He could smell the thick odor of her fur. Both Imos and Mattis were surprised to find Mattis in such close proximity, and both paused before Mattis regained his sense and punched the Gorgon as hard as he could in her chest. Nothing. It was as if an insect had bumped into her mid-flight, only less annoying. Imos looked down at him from her great height and bellowed an enormous spittle-filled roar, her hot, meaty breath clogging Mattis's nose and throat until he stumbled backward. She reached out to grab him and was again caught off guard by Lorica, who flew in from behind, landing both of her feet on the Gorgon's back and taking them all to the ground. If Imos had been playing an aggressive Gorgon game earlier, now she was truly incensed. She thrashed at Mattis and Lorica wildly, clawing huge scratches in Mattis's chest. She tried to rise, but Lorica wrapped her arms around Imos tightly and struggled to keep her in the mud where perhaps the chaos would give the Gorgon the disadvantage.
"Her legs!"
Lorica managed to grunt before Imos belted her across the jaw, but to Lorica's credit, she held fast. Mattis managed to follow directions and wrap himself around Imos's thrashing legs. Her knee pounded against his scratched chest, sending a blaze of pain throughout his torso that he could feel in the tips of his fingers. But he held on as Lorica again pressed herself into the Gorgon's matted fur and stroked Imos's head. It was a strange way to fight, but it seemed to calm the Gorgon at least a little, though she did still kick out every few seconds, sending fresh bursts of pain through Mattis. Lorica's lips were moving, but Mattis couldn't make out what she was saying. Then the shock came. A bolt of electricity coursed through the Gorgon's body and then through Mattis's and Lorica's too, rending them apart from each other. They landed heavily in the dirt, panting to catch their breaths. Imos tried to stand against the purple current that danced about her, singeing her fur, and the guard holding the electro staff pulsed her again. This time, the Gorgon fell face first into the mud, then rolled onto her side, purring softly in pain, clutching her stomach against the diminishing current. Lorica pulled herself to her knees. Her jaw was bruised from the Gorgon's punch. Her hair was caked to her face with mud, and her arms, where they weren't covered, were scraped. Mattis held his head just high enough from the ground to take her in, feeling a tiny whirlwind of anger and sorrow, of gratitude and remorse, before rolling himself over to a sitting position. Once there, when he had caught his breath and the fold around him came back into focus, only then did he recognize the guard who'd broken up their fight. It was AG-90, polished to a new sheen, his chest plate bearing the unmistakable insignia of the First Order. Chapter 6.
"We need to go somewhere,"
Sari yelled in Deck's ear. Deck wasn't as strong a pilot as AG-90, but he'd done enough hunting and trapping from his modified speeder bike back on Quest to deal with distractions while he piloted.
"We are going somewhere," he hollered back.
It was unlike Sari to shout. It was unlike Deck to reply unkindly. They weren't acting like themselves. But in fairness, they were being pursued by First Order shuttles through a ring of detritus that circled the swamp planet below.
"Where? You're just dodging space junk,"
Sari reasoned. She was back to her usual low tone and volume.
"You have to stop yelling at me,"
Deck said, unable to resist making the joke. He banked their shuttle hard to avoid some rather mean-looking debris.
"Deck?"
Sari rested her hand on his shoulder.
"We have to get away from here."
Was she telling him to save their own lives, to leave the others on Vodran with the First Order? Deck wouldn't, and Sari ought to know that he wouldn't.
"I won't leave him, Sari," he said. "I'm not leaving our friends, my brother,"
Deck said with what he hoped was finality.
"Great. Perfect. All we need to do is evade the First Order on our tails and avoid the space junk all around us,"
Sari complained,
"and conserve enough fuel to get us back to Vodran to save them from who knows what. Now, this would be easier if we had artillery."
"Look on the bright side," Deck told her. "The First Order shuttles must not have artillery either, or we wouldn't even be in this jam." Deck smiled and banked the shuttle again, just avoiding half a discarded skiff floating along inconveniently. Deck, do something, Sari said. Deck nodded. He could outmaneuver these wingdings. He dodged driftbark on the swamps of Quest since he was 5 years old. Deck flew the shuttle over and through the debris, which stretched into a long belt of metal and other refuse across the curve of the planet below. I'm going to get closer to some of this stuff, Deck told Sari. Hold on to something. Sari already looked pretty green. She fell back into one of the passenger seats and strapped herself in, tugging the flimsy belt across her massive body. Deck bore toward a spinning piece of metal just ahead of them. His brother would have slipped over and around that hunk of debris with ease and flair. Deck knew he could do it, but the best he could hope for was minor damage to their own shuttle and the chance that one of their pursuers would hit it. When he should have slowed down, Deck gunned the shuttle's engines and flew within meters of the spinning wreckage. A jagged edge came up and ground against his ship. Deck pulled abruptly upward, turning and spinning the shuttle as smaller debris buffeted the cockpit, sparking and chafing the glass. Behind and below, their closest pursuer wasn't so lucky. The First Order shuttle didn't pull up as Deck had done, and the spiked metal junk sliced raggedly through it. Its pilot floated off into space, and what remained of his ship joined the rest of the wreckage in dangerous orbit.
Deck? What's that?
Sari leaned forward in her seat, squinting through the viewport. More junk, probably, Deck said, flipping switches and turning dials on his flight controls while attempting to avoid any more close calls, but still keep the two remaining shuttles off his back.
No. Look, she demanded.
Kinda busy right now, pal, Deck replied.
Deck, look out!
Deck was so busy staring down at his flight screens that he barely noticed the small moon into whose orbit they were flying. Their shuttle juddered and banked as they flew into the moon's gravitational sphere, and Deck pulled hard on his controls. They shot down into the moon's clouded atmosphere. Behind them, one of their pursuing ships lost control and, unable to compensate for the moon's gravity or its sudden entry, spun front to back over and over, then plummeted to the surface. No one could have survived the crash. The other First Order ship lost them in the clouds, for the moment. It was another minute before Deck fully regained control and they could take in their surroundings.
What is this? Deck asked.
It's a moon, Sari told him.
Not one of Vodran's, he said. This moon, if it is one, didn't show up on scans.
Deck took in the heavy, low cloud cover and the empty green swaths of land below.
Why didn't it show up on scans, Sari?
Sari shrugged.
Could be any number of things, she said. Could be a naturally occurring phenomenon, like some mineral deposits below its crust make it invisible to scans. Could be that someone is cloaking it somehow. I mean, I guess that technology is possible.
She sounded more curious than fearful, though. Deck thought it ought to be the other way around. But Sari had a scientific mind, and this invisible moon had piqued her interest. The comm had stopped squawking since they had entered the moon's orbit. Sari studied it, intrigued, then turned back to Deck.
Look, she said, sensing his apprehension. We ditched two of those First Order scouts, but that other one knows we're here. He followed us down here. Whatever is masking the moon from outside scans also makes communication from its orbit impossible. Comm channel is quiet, right? That's a good thing. He can't signal Vodran that we're here.
Unless he turns around and leaves the moon.
But then he risks losing us altogether. Scans don't work here due to whatever is blocking the moon itself.
What are you getting at, Sari?
I'm saying this invisible moon is a good place to hide. Even if the First Order sends a whole squadron, they won't be able to find us until they literally fall into our laps.
Deck considered it. He didn't like the idea of cooling their heels on some ghost moon while his brother and their friends were down on Vodran.
It's as good a plan as we have right now, Sari said. We can stay here and regroup, at least. We won't be able to send out communications, but no one, First Order or Resistance, will be able to find us either. And that's okay for now, isn't it?
We can't just fly in circles, Deck said, surveying the visible stretches of land in front of him, what he could see through the low fog anyway.
No, we'll have to find somewhere to set down, Sari agreed. Like there!
She pointed to where a small gray bunker appeared as if it had been dropped into a green pasture.
What is it?
Only one way to find out. At least it isn't a First Order stronghold, Sari reasoned. They'd never hole up in something so ugly.
Deck knew he was supposed to laugh, but he couldn't. He piloted the shuttle toward the bunker, knowing even as he did that it was a dangerous idea. Chapter 7
I'm hungry.
It was the first thing Lorica had said to Mattis in hours. After AG-90, now a first-order guard droid, broke up their fight in the fold, he'd escorted Mattis, Lorica, and Kost back to their cell and left them to stew. That's what he'd said.
Stew over what you did!
It was and it wasn't the kind of thing the old AG might say. There was something different about his voice and the way he carried himself, not to mention the First Order insignia on his chest plate. But stew over what you did? Mattis just didn't know what to make of that. He wanted to talk to Lorica about it, but upon arriving at their cell, she slumped in her bunk with her arms crossed. A stormtrooper eventually brought in antiseptic wipes and some gauze dressings, the latter of which did not look sterile at all. But they did the job of mopping up the blood that had crusted on their wounds, and though he was still a bit wobbly from the electroshock AG had given them, Mattis did feel better once he'd cleaned himself up. At least he wasn't finding Gagorin fur in uncomfortable places.
I'm hungry, too,
Mattis said, realizing as he said it that it was true. Lorica glared at him.
Hey,
Mattis said with more anger in his tone than he'd intended, but then he was hungry, and that was making him cranky.
I didn't start that fight.
You didn't finish it either, Lorica huffed.
Neither did you. AG did, our friend. He electroshocked us.
Doesn't look like he's our friend anymore, Lorica said with venom.
No, it doesn't, Mattis agreed angrily. Don't you think we should talk about that?
Why? It's obviously too late. They got him. They got Joe. Who do you think is next?
She raised an eyebrow, implying that it wouldn't be her.
That Gagorin did not like you, for starters.
Kost chirped from her perch above Lorica, then pealed into loud, sharp laughter.
Hey, come on, Mattis said. That's not fair. I didn't do anything.
You actually didn't do anything, Lorica agreed. You barely got out of the way.
Mattis didn't think that was true. He thought that, faced with a rampaging Gagorin, he had done just about enough. Which was, sure, very little, but he didn't get his face clawed off either, so he considered himself successful. Mattis let out a long sigh, signaling to Lorica that he didn't want to say what he was about to say, but that was a show, of course. He was happy that they were talking.
Thanks for saving me, he said. What else was I gonna do? She responded.
Her cool response was undermined when her stomach rumbled irritably.
I'm so hungry, she complained.
They have to feed us eventually, right? Mattis reasoned.
Kost hopped down off her bunk and started her pacing ritual. Back and forth she went, flapping her arms and running them up and down along the back wall.
Do you hear it? She asked.
When they didn't respond, she repeated,
Do you hear it? Do you hear it?
Her perseverance made Mattis wish he'd had his ears ripped off by the Gagorin.
They can do whatever they want, Mattis, Lorica said sharply. We're their prisoners.
But they want information, right?
They probably already have it. They reprogrammed AG, so maybe they got whatever he had out of him before they did that. And Joe, like you said, he doesn't care about us.
Did I say that?
You said he turned, or that he was never one of us at all. Same thing. I'm sure he told them everything by now. Do you hear it? Do you hear it?
Kost's refrain grew louder and faster.
Do you hear it? Do you hear it?
Kost, shut up, Lorica spat and cursed their cellmate in Zeltron.
Well, maybe he didn't, Mattis shouted.
Somehow he'd wound up in the odd position of defending Joe. Maybe it was the hunger that was making his mind as weak as his body.
Let's pretend he did, Lorica snapped. It's what you were trying to tell me before, so let's just say they know everything that we know.
Which isn't much, is it?
I know some things,
Mattis countered, annoyed.
You don't know anything. You don't even know where the resistance base is.
You don't either.
The scratching, scratching. It's in the walls, friendies. It's in the walls.
Kost pounded on the walls with her little fists and yelled,
Do you hear it? Do you hear it?
I know more than you do,
Lorica stood now, bumping her head on the upper bunk, swearing again.
Kotugi, Mattis! She yelled.
Don't get mad at me,
Mattis shouted. If they were going to continue this fight, then yelling was their best option to hear one another over costs carrying on.
Scratching, scratching!
Who else am I going to get mad at? Yourself? Your boyfriend, Joe?
For the last time, Joe isn't my boyfriend. And anyway, we wouldn't even be on this stink planet if it weren't for your boyfriend, Deck.
Deck isn't my boyfriend.
Mattis didn't even know what they were arguing about anymore.
Of course not. If he cared about you at all, he'd have turned his shuttle around and come to find us. But he didn't. He and that oaf sorry just took off.
Well, at least
what?
They were in each other's faces, ready to come to blows. Mattis wouldn't make the first move, and he hoped Lorica wouldn't either. She would definitely win a physical altercation against him. Heck, she'd nearly beaten that Gagorin.
So loud in my ears, so loud in the walls,
Cost moaned and rocked in her corner.
At least I'm a nice person,
Mattis finally yelled. Lorica burst out laughing and gave him a shove. It wasn't at her full strength, he was sure, but then neither of them were. Still, it wasn't exactly a playful shove, and he fell back into his bunk, banging the back of his head on the overhead bar.
Ow!
Just shut up already, Mr. Nice Person, Lorica growled.
Make it stop, make it stop, make it stop so loud,
Cost wailed.
You shut up too,
Lorica yelled into Cost's corner. But Cost was back up again, pacing and running her thin fingers along the back wall.
Quiet in there, prisoners!
AG's voice, though mechanical and missing his characteristic drawl, was still unmistakable. He appeared a moment later, standing ramrod straight before their cell door.
AG!
Mattis said, surprised. As he'd appeared in the fold, AG seemed both himself and not himself. He was somehow more mechanical. Over the course of knowing him, Mattis had come to think of AG-90 not just as a droid, but as Deck's brother, as a friend. Mattis had ceased seeing any difference between himself and his friend. AG could think and act, and just like Mattis, he wanted to fly.
That's me, AG said flatly. You prisoners ought to stop yelling. You're liable to raise unwanted attention. You hear?
Mattis nodded. He didn't like this new AG-90. He missed his friend.
If you're not here to help us, then I don't know why you're here, Mattis said.
He hoped he conveyed the disappointment he felt. He hoped it sliced through AG's programming. The droid gave no indication that it had. AG's presence had done one thing, though, and that was to further agitate Cost. She threw herself against the cell bars and grasped them so tightly that her knuckles turned white.
Stop the noise!
She shouted in AG's faceplate.
It's noisome and stop it, stop it, stop it!
Step back, prisoner,
AG ordered, but Cost went on barking and pleading for him to stop the noise, stop the scritching in the walls.
The scritching is in your brain, prisoner, AG said dryly.
Cost persisted, banging her fists on the bars, trying to shake them but finding herself unable. The bars were too strong. She stopped only when Ingo Salik made his imperious presence known by clearing his throat. He touched Cost's fingers where they held the bars, and she let go. Cost turned to Lorica, standing beside her, and pointed.
She pet the Gagorin,
Cost said. Ingo offered a small, good-natured smile.
From the report I received, I don't think the Gagorin was too pleased by it.
She tried to eat me, the Gagorin, I mean, Mattis told Ingo.
Don't be silly. Gagorins don't eat people, Ingo remarked, then added mockingly, usually.
Could you blame her?
Lorica asked, stepping toward the bars, standing within a meter of Ingo.
It's not like we get fed in this cage.
Mattis didn't think that challenging their jailer was a good way to curry favor, but Ingo's features softened as Lorica locked eyes with him. There was something about Lorica, even when she was antagonistic, that made a person want to engage with her. Maybe even more so when she was being antagonistic, which was her default manner anyway.
Have you not been fed? Ingo asked.
The way he said it made them sound like chickens in a coop, which was probably his intention.
That's our error, Miss Damaris. So you know my name, Lorica remarked.
Ingo only nodded and maintained his thin smile. It took Mattis a moment to get to where Lorica already stood. Ingo hadn't known their names when last he visited them. Now he did, which meant that Ingo and his commander, Wanton, had received information from someone. Maybe AG, before he was reprogrammed, or more likely Joe was reporting to the First Order. For now, as far as they knew, it was just their names. But what would come next? Mattis was sure AG didn't know the location of the Resistance base, but Joe, as squadron leader, probably did. Lorica had implied as much, and that was dangerous knowledge to have under capture. Lorica took a step forward, any closer and her nose would poke through the bars, but now she was a breath away from Ingo. Mattis was so worried about this confrontation he felt as if his head were going to jump off his neck. His pulse reached a crescendo, and suddenly everything stopped being so dire. It was as if Mattis had spent all of his worrying and had just completely run out of concern. Everything moved slowly and placidly as if underwater. As Ingo reached into his jacket pocket, Mattis didn't even tense. Everything was just so calm. Lorica remained nose to nose with Ingo on opposite sides of the bars. Ingo removed a small rectangular foil-wrapped packet. Cost quieted to a soft humming. Ingo lifted the packet to eye level and placed it on the bar between his and Lorica's faces. He held on to one end of it. Languidly, Lorica raised her own hand and took the other end. They remained there for a moment, each touching one end of the silver packet. Then Lorica grasped it tighter and snatched the whole packet into her hand. She took a step back from the bars, and whatever spell they'd fallen under was broken. The world moved at normal speed again. His head spinning, Mattis dropped back onto his bunk. Ingo nodded, stepped back, turned on his boot heel, and exited the way he had come. Lorica turned to Mattis, her eyes wide. She ripped open the silver packet to reveal 6 gelatinous cubes. "Is that..." Mattis began, unable to believe his own eyes. His stomach finished the question for him. Lorica nodded. She still seemed dazed from whatever hocus-pocus had just transpired, as if she could feel it too, and why not? She was just as spent as Mattis was. "It's a ration pack," she said. She broke off 3 of the cubes and tossed them to Mattis. "Eat," she said. Mattis gulped one down without even tasting it, which was probably for the best. The protein cubes that came in ration packs were notoriously sickly sweet, like eating sugar boiled in hockey nectar, which was to say cloyingly sweet. He felt the nutrients jolt him with energy before the cube was even all the way down his throat. Lorica held her first cube on her tongue, clearly not minding the syrupy sweetness, savoring the rush of energy she got from finally consuming some food. Mattis went to place a 2nd cube in his mouth and then stopped. Kost rocked back and forth in the corner, one hand splayed up against the back wall, as if she could somehow keep it from falling in on her that way. She was drawn and skinny. Mattis took one of his 2 remaining protein cubes and held it out to Kost. She only seemed to recognize what it was after a blink. Then she rose up unsteadily and Mattis placed the cube in her hand.
"Thanks a bucket," she said.
She slipped the cube into her mouth like she was taking back a secret. Lorica watched the transaction take place, sighed, and offered Kost one of her cubes as well. Kost took it and put it into her mouth with the other cube, which hadn't yet dissolved.
"Don't choke on it," Lorica said unhappily.
Mattis could tell she'd wanted all 3 for herself, but she hadn't taken them. Indeed, she'd first given half her bounty to Mattis and then a 3rd to Kost. They were together in this.
"Thank you," Mattis said to her. The words didn't contain the galaxy of gratitude he actually felt.
"Mm-hmm." She nodded, the 1st cube still on her tongue.
"What did you..."
Mattis began. He wasn't sure how to ask. He wasn't even sure what he was asking.
"Did you do something to him?"
It came out sounding accusatory, and Mattis wished it hadn't.
"No."
Lorica was defensive.
"I didn't mean... I don't know the words," Mattis said. "But it's like... Do you have the Force?"
Something in the question surprised and disappointed Mattis. A part of him thought that if Lorica possessed the Force, it would mean he didn't. Of course, that was a ridiculous notion. In the days of the old stories, there were plenty of Force users.
I don't, Lorica replied, because there's no such thing.
Mattis didn't think this was the time to argue, as much as he wanted to convince her of the truth.
Then how did...
he began, unsure again how the question should be asked. She sighed and crooked her mouth, as if this were something she'd given a great deal of thought, which she had.
I've been realizing this for a while, Lorica said. I think there's something about me.
Mattis wanted to tell her that there were lots of things about her, things about which he'd given a great deal of thought, but for once, he thought it better to shut up and let her continue. This wasn't easy for her to explain.
There are rumors, legends, I don't know, about my people, about Zeltron people. They say that we can sort of affect things, feelings, and others.
Like mind control? Mattis asked.
Brain itching? Yelled Cost.
Mattis went to shush her, but Lorica stopped him with a hand held up.
It kind of is like brain itching.
Brain itching isn't a thing that anyone's heard of, Mattis pointed out.
No, Lorica agreed. I guess not, but it's
like emotion massaging, if that makes sense.
It doesn't.
Mattis, don't get angry with me. I'm trying to explain. Mattis apologized.
They say that Zeltrons have these pheromones, like we radiate something, a smell or a feeling that makes people like us.
I mean, more than we're already likable. She smiled at her own joke.
It has a calming effect on people, and Gagorans, apparently.
That's why you were petting Emos, Mattis said, understanding.
Yeah, Lorica replied. Being that close to her and soothing her as I was, I think it calmed her down.
A little bit, sure, Mattis agreed.
Hey, Lorica snapped. She's a Gagoran, and I'm new at this, but I think if I were better at it, if I practiced, I could put her to sleep.
Is that what you did with Ingo?
Not exactly. I think...
She shook her head, though the notion didn't embarrass her at all.
I think he likes me, so I sort of used that.
Mattis nodded. It made sense Ingo hadn't had his mind controlled by Lorica, but that haze he'd been in was real. He knew what he was doing, giving her the ration packet. Part of him wanted to give it to her, but Lorica's ability had pushed him so that he didn't mind actually doing it. Mattis thought back to his own interactions with Lorica, from the time they'd met on the transport to the resistance base. She hadn't been nice to him, but he'd been drawn to her nonetheless. And over time, as they got to know each other, he'd seen beneath the thorny front she presented to the good person who was inside of her. She'd saved him and Deck and AG and the others many times, and every time she did, well, really every time she did anything, Mattis liked her a little bit more. He saw where that affection was going. He'd felt the same for his pal Jinbi back on Dirk Teal, though he'd resisted it, and they'd remained just friends. It wouldn't help to get a crush on someone who was his friend and often his sparring partner, but his feelings were as strong and undeniable as the Force itself. This new information rankled him. If just being near her enhanced every feeling Mattis had, then were his feelings for her real? Were they even friends? Or was she just itching his brain to make her life easier? Did it make any difference that she'd only recently realized she had these abilities? Was it even true? Mattis didn't want to explore those questions, and he pushed down any feelings that were simmering. After all, he didn't need Lorica making them worse. He'd wait until they had some time to themselves, and then maybe he could figure out how he actually felt. Of course, time to himself seemed unlikely in their cramped cell.
You're mad, Lorica said to him.
I'm not mad, Mattis said, sounding very mad.
I'm not mad either.
Cost piped up.
I don't care if you're mad, Lorica told her.
You should, Cost hiccuped. When I'm mad, I get angry.
Lorica shook her head. Mattis could tell that she didn't want to have the conversation either. She was, as she often was, all business. He met her eye, if only for a moment.
We can use this ability I have, to escape.
How? Mattis huffed.
I got Ingo to give me the rations packet, didn't I? She cocked her head at him. He could tell that she needed him to listen and to understand the sense of what she was saying, but he was having trouble concentrating, as he usually did when she was around. With this new information, zeroing in on an idea was difficult. Maybe I can get him to let us go, Lorica continued. Mattis stared at her through slitted eyes. How are you going to make him want to let us go? Are you going to get him to fall in love with you? No. I'll get him to see me as a person instead of as a prisoner, Lorica barked. Okay. When? He crossed his arms. She shook her head at him. I don't know when, she sighed. I don't even know if it'll work. I can at least try. That's more than you're doing, sulking. They were fighting again. Mattis didn't mind so much this time. I'm doing something, too. What are you doing? I've been thinking of a plan since I got here, he said, omitting or trying to from the end of the statement. What have you got so far? And then, all at once, and just at that moment, Mattis thought of a plan. He hoped it was due to having been trying to think of one since he got there. He would accept that maybe the Force had just then whispered a plan to his brain. He hoped it wasn't Lorica itching an idea into his head. I'm collecting scraps. Lorica shot a question at him with a hard look. Like what we're doing on Vodran in the first place, right? Maybe that's my special ability, the ability to find garbage. Mattis, what are you talking about? They'll put us to work outside at some point, he said. You saw some of the other prisoners out there, working on the fences and digging outside the fold. I saw them. If we keep quiet, and if A.G. and Joe don't tell them everything just yet, which they already may have, Lorica pointed out. Maybe, Mattis agreed. But then, why keep us around? Lorica nodded. Assuming we still have information they want and they keep us around, they'll put us to work. This detention center is only half completed. Wanton, the guy in charge, told me that. I'm sure I can find some scraps to use to get through this wall or under it. Can't go under, Kost burst out. Both Mattis and Lorica shushed her. She whispered, can't go under. Gotta go through. Scritch, scratch. Okay, Mattis said, humoring her. I will. But Lorica, seriously, I'm sure I can find something to dig through. There's nothing on the other side of this wall but the open meadow that they caught us in. And probably a whole mess of stormtroopers ready to blast us. Maybe. But maybe we can outrun them. Maybe we can get a ship or a speeder bike or something and get out of here. It's worth a shot, isn't it? Lorica was quiet for a moment. It is, she finally said. Do it. Gather whatever you can find. Even if it's no good for digging and scraping away at the wall, maybe we can use what you find for weapons if we need. Meanwhile, I'll work on my plan. A part of Mattis wasn't eager to acknowledge that he recognized Lorica's plan to get Ingo on their side was a good one. If anyone could pull it off, she could. She was the most capable, toughest person he knew. A louder, more persistent part of him hoped she failed. He didn't want to see Ingo fall in love with her. Chapter 8 I have a really lousy feeling here, Deck told Sari as he brought their shuttle in for a landing by the gray bunker that sat in the middle of an expanse of deep dark green. You want to go back and face those First Order scouts? Or maybe go all the way back to Vodran and just hunt around for our friends until we get eaten by Rancors or Tods or worse? Sari responded, leaning over his shoulder to watch the ground grow closer beneath them. Nothing's worse than a Tod, Deck said, setting the shuttle down. He stood up. He was glad to be back on solid ground anyway, even if they were facing the unknown. At the very least, maybe the bunker would have some fuel. They were low after all that evasive flying. They packed some rations and hydration, as well as a stun rod they'd been given to ward off Dianogas on Vodran, and walked down the boarding ramp into an eerie silence. Thick mist swirled around them, and they could barely make out the bunker in the near distance. There were no signs of life. Maybe it's abandoned, Sari reasoned. You'd think someone living by himself on an invisible moon in the outer rim is going to welcome us with a parade? Deck replied.
Good point. But now that you ask, that's what I'd vastly prefer.
When Dex shot her a skeptical half-scowl, Sari shrugged.
What? Parades are fun.
They took a few steps forward before Dex put away his flashlight.
Light's just bouncing off the mist, he said. We're walking in blind.
Okay, Sari said.
Then, steeling herself, she added,
What's the worst we could find?
As they moved toward the bunker, a large paneled door slid up. Through the haze, they couldn't see inside at all, but figures emerged from within. A gang of indistinct shapes, maybe a dozen of them, moved eerily to intercept Dex and Sari. Dex set his stun rod to charge. It hummed softly. Sari clenched her hands into tight fists the size of young Ewok's heads.
What do you think? Dex asked. Guavian Death Gang?
Craigallan Marauders from Snowden 4? Asked Sari.
The Galgardi Syndicate? Narino Horde? Estepona Party Squad?
Sari shot him a puzzled look. Dex explained.
They're cannibals.
Oh.
Dex and Sari hunched in ready positions. Maybe they would die on this invisible moon, and no one would ever know what happened to them. That they died fighting. That they died together, great friends, defending each other to the end.
The Mangan Ring?
Bloody Montantis?
Droids.
Droids?
Look, she said, pointing. They're droids.
We can definitely fight droids, Dex said.
They're droids,
Sari shook her head, trying to explain.
We probably won't have to fight them. How many territorial droids do you know? If they were sentries, they would have attacked already. No one sends a bunch of broken-down droids to fight, do they?
As the figures came more clearly into view, Dex saw that they were broken-down droids. A dozen of them, in various states of disrepair, all different classes and types. Some wobbly protocol droids of different heights, a floating probe droid with only a few spindly legs remaining, an astromech stutter-rolled, stopped, then continued toward them, emitting a low, prolonged tone. And more, a medical droid with half a head, a hulking construction droid, a lightweight navigation droid whose right hand had been replaced with the dual laser cannons of a B-2 battle droid. She must have been their leader, for she met Dex and Sari first, stopping a couple of meters from them and raising her cannons. Behind her, her droid cohort softly beeped and booped, blinking their signal lights. Dex put down his stun rod and raised his hands.
We don't want any trouble, he said.
Sari put her hands in the air, too, and nodded.
No trouble.
The navigation droid didn't lower her cannons, even when all the robots lifted their heads skyward. A dirty gray and white astromech droid buzzed close to Dex. It passed him, and his stun rod was gone.
I might need that, Dex said casually. The B-2 and the others all leveled their gazes at the interlopers.
They moved forward again, surrounding Dex and Sari.
What are they doing?
Dex asked. He was used to asking her things. Sari knew everything.
Ask them, she answered.
They don't seem real chatty.
The oddball collection of droids walked, rolled, and hovered closer and closer. Too close, Dex said to no effect. He and Sari started pushing back, but the droids were solid. They wouldn't be moved. Sari lost her footing and stumbled, but didn't fall. The droids around her were so tightly packed that they held her up. They held Dex just as firmly and started moving. As one, slowly, centimeter by centimeter, the droids pushed Dex and Sari along inside their metal cocoon, herding them toward the bunker.
Let us out,
Dex managed, but he didn't know which droid he was telling. Maybe all of them.
He felt his jacket pulled off him. He grasped for it, tugging at the sleeve as it was stripped from him, but the droids were too strong.
His satchel slipped to the ground and they walked over it. He bumped against Sari and she put her arm around him.
Let's go with them, she said. We don't have a choice anyway.
They stopped resisting and allowed the droids to carry them toward the dark open mouth of the bunker. Some of the mist had cleared. The sun was shining harder and brighter than it had been, and Dex and Sari watched as the nav droid trekked out about halfway to their shuttle and raised her cannons again.
There was a thrum as she activated them, and then two electric spitting sounds, thum, thum, as she fired. plasma shots struck Deck and Sari's shuttle and it exploded. None of the droids moved against the thunderous noise or the hot fire that followed. Deck, catching Sari's look, read in it his own thoughts precisely. They were stuck there. They were doomed. Things could not get worse. Then they got worse. Deck and Sari heard it before they saw it, a First Order scout shuttle descending outside the bunker where they'd just stood, where their smoldering wreck still remained. They saw the First Order pilot through the cockpit viewport, a stern-looking young man not much older than Deck himself. The First Order shuttle touched down, and the nav droid, now wearing Deck's jacket, walked out to meet it. Deck touched his head. He'd scraped it on one of the droid's chassis during the pressed-in throng. It was bleeding. That was the least of his worries right then, though. The droids were about to turn him and Sari over to the First Order. Chapter 9. The difference between wakefulness and sleep while he was a prisoner of the First Order on Vodrin was, to Mattis, a negligible one. When the thick gray afternoon gave way to the inky darkness of night, Mattis lay on his mattress and stared at the springs of the bunk above him until it became too black to see even those. He listened to Kost's whining, which fell to muttering, then to a fitful series of inhalations and exhalations as she dropped deeper into slumber. Across from him, Lorica was silent, only occasionally turning, growing annoyed in her sleep that she couldn't find a comfortable position, then accepting her sorry state and returning to stillness. Mattis heard all this for hours and hours until he finally drifted off to a poor approximation of sleep. It was never restful. Any sound, even from far away, woke Mattis with a start. He lived in an ever-present state of alarm, always at the ready, always prepared to fight or flee. It wouldn't surprise him to wake one night to find the enraged Gagorin Ima standing over him, her gargantuan paws ready to smother him or claw him to shreds. Nor would it astound him if Lorica jogged him awake to tell him it was time to go, that her plan had worked, that Ingo would free them, and all she had to do was promise Ingo her hand in marriage. His dread upon waking, Mattis both understood and feared, would be the same for either situation, and he dwelled upon both in his thoughts day in and day out. Occasionally, another notion surfaced, that he would celebrate birthday upon birthday, growing frail and gray-haired in this detention center, first under Wanton's irked command and then under Ingo's more genial despotism. In that nightmare reverie, Lorica turned to the First Order and became Ingo's paramour. The two of them, and sometimes Joe and A.G. too, tyrannical in their treatment of the prisoners and of Mattis in particular. And then, once, in a rare while, Mattis allowed himself to hope. He thought, as he'd done upon first arriving at the detention center, of General Leia. He might even smile in those times, albeit briefly. He allowed himself to think of Deck and Sari and the possibility that they had escaped Vodrin and would return for their friends. It was Deck and Sari arriving in their shuttle, animated by adventures of their own, that Mattis dreamed of now as the real-world sounds of his cellmates grew abstract and his friend's arrival felt true. It was in this moment that thin fingers touched his shoulder, and he jerked to a sitting position, throwing out his arms and, in the process, shoving Kost sprawling onto the floor. "Hey," Kost said. "Shut up," Lorica said. There was no sleep in her voice. "Sorry," Mattis said. "Kost woke me." "Don't care," Lorica groaned. Mattis heard her bedsprings complain as she rolled away from them. It was too dark to see whether Kost had returned to her bed, but Mattis assumed she had. She hadn't. Mattis felt those fingers return to his shoulder, pressing insistently. "Hey, are you awake now?" He could just make out the shape of her kneeling beside him. "Now, yeah," he said. "I don't hear the scritching," Kost told him. "Good," Mattis said, willing her away. "That's good, Kost. Get some sleep." "Do you hear it?" Mattis sat up in his bunk. Kost scrambled up, too, as if invited, and sat across from him with her legs crossed under her. Mattis cocked his head and listened for the scratching in the walls that he knew wasn't there. "I don't hear anything," he told her.
"Then it won't hear us either," she said, nodding confident.
"Is something wrong, Kost?" Mattis asked. He really wanted to ask if something was right. Mattis couldn't remember Cost being quite so lucid in the time he'd known her.
"Everything's wrong," she whispered.
She sounded haunted. "Did you find something out? Did Ingo or one of the stormtroopers say something?" Mattis started to panic.
"I know some things," Cost said.
"What do you know?" Mattis asked desperately. His voice was rising, and now Cost shushed him, a first.
"I know that there are things in this universe beyond us," she said. "There are things beyond our understanding."
"I see," Mattis said, emitting a heavy sigh of relief. Cost wasn't talking about anything happening at the detention center. No one was coming for them. She was talking about philosophy. She was talking about religion. She'd gotten to thinking about her place in the galaxy and the meaning of life itself. She was talking about the Force.
"You don't understand," Cost insisted.
"You're talking about the Force, the energy created by all living things. It brings us together, us, the galaxy, everything." Mattis recited concepts he'd learned in his firmest temple back on Dirk Teal and ideas he'd gathered from the old stories he collected.
"You're stupid," Cost told him.
"I'm not. That's what the Force is."
"Not talking about any Force."
Mattis felt he had to explain and defend himself. "Cost, the Force is the oldest and most powerful energy in the galaxy. In any galaxy."
"Shh.
Sorry. It's just, there's nothing else. If you're talking about something overwhelming and ancient, that's the Force. If you're talking about things beyond understanding, well, most people don't understand the Force, except for Jedi." He didn't add that he understood the Force, that it was with him, and that someday he'd have the opportunity to explore it fully, if he ever got out of this cell.
"Oh," Cost said.
Mattis saw her nodding in the dark.
"Okay. You're stupid."
"Stop calling me stupid."
"Stop being stupid," she whisper yelled. "And shh."
"Cost, if you don't mean the Force, please tell me what you're talking about." Mattis was exhausted. This conversation was wearing him out even more.
"I'm talking about evil," she said,
her voice a thin whisper in the dark between them. A tremor climbed up and down Mattis's spine.
"Evil, old and strong. You don't feel it in this place?"
Cost shivered and inhaled sharply. "I don't feel it," Mattis admitted. It was true. In this place, he felt afraid. He felt alone. He felt helpless and chilled to the bone, despite the planet's crushing humidity. But he didn't sense anything in the way that Cost was talking about.
"What do you mean?" he asked. "You know what this place used to be?"
"Har the Hutt's stronghold," he said.
"Big mouths, stubby arms, big fat worms," Cost said.
"I know what huts are."
"The Hutt was mean."
"All huts are mean."
"Not all,"
Cost said innocently.
"But Hara was mean. Wookiee who had her lunch stolen kind of mean."
Mattis remembered the menagerie that Hara the Hutt had collected on this planet, the angry creatures who'd chased them down, the rancors who'd eaten Klimo. Those were pets for only the cruelest sort of being. Hara the Hutt must have been mean to trade in those creatures.
"You know what these boxes were?"
Cost asked. "You mean these cells?" Cost nodded. Mattis shrugged. "I guess I didn't think about it."
"These boxes were the Hutt's torture pits."
Again, that tremor racked Mattis. But wait, it didn't make sense.
"These aren't pits," he told Cost. "They're rooms. These were probably storage facilities."
Cost laughed humorlessly.
"Pit isn't always a pit," she explained. "Hutt kept her enemies in these cages, didn't feed them, sent her guards in to torture and to torment."
"Cost, were you here then? When this was Hara the Hutt's palace, were you in the torture pits?" Mattis felt his stomach lurch. If Cost had suffered under Hara the Hutt, that would explain her loose grip on reality.
Kost was here. Kost is still here.
She patted his knee.
I'm tougher than any Hutt, she told him. I can stand it, the scritching and scratching, the muttering and complaining of the devil in the walls.
There she went again, the devil in the walls.
You don't believe,
Kost said.
But believe, Mattis, this place isn't just walls and bars. This place has scars. It remembers the evils done here over many years. They imprint on the structure, in its bones.
But you're tough, Mattis said, hoping to help Kost from the emotional well into which she was lowering herself.
I am tough, but this place, it makes you forget hope. It makes you think you'll never leave. Do you think that sometimes?
Mattis admitted he did.
That's what the ghosts here do. That's what the haunts here do. They suck it out of you, out from your heart. First sucks away your hope, and then it chews up your mind. You have to hang on to your mind.
I'm trying.
Don't try. Do it. Do it, do it, do it. Because you don't want to hear the rasping, scraping thing in the walls. Once you hear that, then you know. Hope? Gone. Mind. Going. Going.
Mattis clung to the edges of his mattress. He felt his face grow hot and clammy.
Then, after all the scritching and scratching, you hear the laughter. So funny. The thing in there, the man in the walls, he thinks everything is a joke. But when you hear the laughing, Mattis, when you hear the laughing, that's when you're all done. Mind is gone. They could set you free that day. They could put you on a shuttle and send you back to your home. But you would still be here. You'd be a prisoner forever. Prisoner of wanton. Prisoner of Hara the Hutt. Prisoner in your own mind.
Mattis choked out a question.
What can I do? Hold on to hope. Find her and keep her.
Hope?
She wants to fly away. She wants to be free of here, but you can't let her go. You need her. In here, you need her most of all. You lose her. You hear the scraping. You hear the walls yammering and calling you names, and then you hear it. Laugh at you. You don't want the walls to laugh at you.
I don't, Mattis said seriously. She took his hand. Her hands were dry and felt fragile, like kindling. Did you lose hope, Kost? Mattis asked her. He was afraid of the answer, but the way she was talking was the most coherent he'd heard her since arriving there. Even if her words were confusing or abstract, she clearly meant them earnestly and was distressed.
Hara the Hutt kept her creatures, she said.
I've seen them, up close.
Not all of them.
Kost stared through Mattis, into the blackness behind him, maybe even through the wall, which was silent to her now.
Hutt took me from vacation, snatched me out of camping site.
You took a vacation on Vodrin?
I fish for Dianoga. They make good soups.
Mattis shook his head. That couldn't possibly be true.
Hutt's bad friends, the ones who hung around her palace and ate her food and teased her animals, they found me and brought me to her. They thought I would make her laugh, or maybe I could work. I couldn't do either, though.
She sighed, remembering sadly.
Hara the Hutt loved her creatures, and mostly she loved to watch them fight. When they wouldn't fight each other, she loved to watch others fight them. She made a Wookiee fight a Rancor one time. Guess who won?
I don't want to think about it.
The Rancor won, by eating the Wookiee. It took longer than you'd think.
Thanks, Mattis said sarcastically.
You're welcome. It's not a heartwarming story, she admitted. It's really not even a story. It's just something that happened, that I saw.
and it isn't the worst thing that I saw.
Cost, Mattis said, when you couldn't work and you couldn't make Hara the Hutt laugh, did she make you fight a rancor?
I could never fight a rancor, Cost said,
as if Mattis were a fool for even asking.
I wouldn't win. I would lose. It would eat me for sure.
I guess it's good you didn't have to fight a rancor then. Cost looked at Mattis as if he were dumb.
Yes,
she said in a voice that told him he was as dumb as her look had suggested.
It's good that I didn't have to fight a rancor.
She shook her head as if to flick away the stupidity in the air.
Hara the Hutt had another pet, a bulgy, clumpy jelly thing, sticky with tentacloids, that grabbed and drank and drank. It liked my sadness and my fear and my lonely feelings.
Mattis started to say he was sorry, but Cost continued.
It drank them up. It took away the things I knew, mother and father and other on Ginhu. They found me in the hendo bushes when I was a sprout. Others, big hands, scooped me up and brought me to their cottage. I used to be able to feel it, those hands, leaving the dry, dry air of the hendo orchard for the cool of the cottage. But no more. The feeling is gone. I know it is fact. I know I had mother and father and other, but I don't know their faces. I don't feel them anymore. The beast took it all with his tentacles. Now I just walk through a sunken dream of them, like finding a story on the images on a smashed face. Bushes and someone hiding inside them, but I don't know if I'm hiding or seeking. A man with teeth on the outside, and others, hand outstretched, but did I take it? And the purple sky, and how wide open it all was. Then...
Cost shrugged and wiped her pointed nose with her filthy sleeve. Then she settled down into herself and said,
anyway, I know I fished for Dianoga, and I know they make good soup.
When the First Order came, Mattis began.
When the First Order came, Cost continued, they used big guns to make holes in the Hutt's throne room. Some of her bad ones got blasted away. Most ran, some are here. Your friend, the pig man, he was one of her bads.
The Gamorrean who'd challenged Mattis in the fold had been part of Hara the Hutt's entourage. Mattis wondered what other prisoners might have been with him and what that might mean for their intentions.
First Order set all of the Hutt's creatures to run free. That was a good thing, I think. They built the fences, but the creatures come back. Hutt fed them, and they want easy foods again. So they come back and Wanton builds more fences, and they knock them down, and then Wanton builds more. But at least Wanton doesn't make prisoners fight creatures.
Cost was optimistic tonight. Why didn't you run, Cost? Mattis asked.
Where to go? Couldn't remember. The jelly beast took it. So Cost stayed, and then it all went away, the faces of mother and father and other and the rest. All that remained were the bars and the walls and the cells. And then the walls got itchy. And then they laughed and laughed and laughed.
Cost dropped her head and sniffled. Mattis didn't know what to say to Cost, who'd lost everything she knew, until he did. Because Mattis still had something to give him hope, and he could share that with her. Cost, he said, nudging her. She sat up again. You know Lorica and I weren't here alone. There was a group of us. Two of our friends got away. Deck and Sari are their names. Deck is my best friend. He's a good pilot, but what he's really good at is getting stuff done. Any situation, Deck can turn it over and over and figure it out. As he talked about his missing friends, Mattis felt hope swell inside him, inflating like a balloon. And Sari is amazing. I think you'll love her. She's big and strong, so strong. She could probably even beat up Emos. She's maybe the smartest person I know.
You said Deck is clever.
Cost was skeptical.
He is. He's clever. It's different. Sari is smart. She knows all kinds of things about all kinds of things. She can work computers like no one I've ever seen. Like, she can talk to them, and she knows about insects and birds and just everything. She reads all the time.
I want to meet this girl who talks to computers,
Kost decided. You will. You will. They got away, Kost. I just know it.
And they'd never just leave us here if there was even a Bantha hair's chance that we're alive. And we are.
Kost looked at Mattis with puzzlement.
Then where are they?
I don't know. Maybe they're headed for a friendly planet so they can contact the Resistance, and the Resistance will come down here in their X-Wings.
Maybe they'll send the big guns, too. Poe Dameron and Snap Wexley and Black Two.
What was his name? I forget, but him too.
I hope they send those big guns,
Kost agreed, angrily sizing up the walls of their cell. They will, Mattis told her.
I just know they will.
They sat there together a moment, nearly hearing the distant X-Wing squadron approaching, believing in their hope and clinging to it because hope was all they had in that gray cage.
Tell me more about the Resistance,
Kost said after a spell of silence.
Yeah, by all means, keep running your mouth.
The voice came out of the darkness beyond the bars. Mattis looked in that direction, and when his eyes adjusted, he saw AG-90's glowing eyes and a glinting light coming off his plating.
AG,
Mattis gasped, starting off his bunk.
Stay where you are, prisoner, AG commanded.
Mattis fell back stiffly.
That's not your friend, Kost told him.
Mattis heard AG's servos whir as the droid shook his head.
This can be easy. You two can have a pajama party if you want, but keep it quiet. You make noise, you get the electro staff. You try anything, you get the electro staff. You open your mouths about anything, anything at all, you get the electro staff. I like using it. Get me?
Mattis nodded. His friend was gone. His years of personality, his tics and idiosyncrasies, all of the things that made AG himself were gone. He wasn't deep down somewhere in this droid, in some secret coding from which Mattis might rescue him, with sentimental speeches or dramatic pleas. This was the new AG-90, ruthless, callous, and nasty.
I can't hear you, prisoner, AG said.
A bright beam of light sliced through the bars into Mattis's bunk. He blinked against the harsh white. Across the brief divide, Lorica sat up in her bunk, shielding her eyes.
What in the name of Patak is going on?
She asked.
I'm telling your bunkie to keep his trap shut. Goes for all of you.
I was sleeping,
Lorica spat.
So how was I going to say anything?
It's a warning,
Kost explained. In the too bright beam, Lorica glared at her.
I get it.
Get it?
AG said, and swept his gaze across all of them.
Good. And get to sleep.
Kost lowered herself from Mattis's bunk and silently climbed back into her own. Mattis hoped she'd remember their talk and find comfort in what he'd said. AG switched off his light and took a step away from them. Then, as if it was an afterthought, he turned back to face them and said,
Your friends? The ones who escaped this planet? They're dead.
Mattis felt his face rush hot and red.
You don't know that!
He shouted.
What'd I say about making a racket? AG said, lifting the electro staff from its holster. It hummed as he charged it up. And don't tell me what I know. I was in the communications center. I heard the call come through. Some of our scouts found your pals circling Vodran. Gave chase. First Order soldiers are good, prisoner. So your friends? Dead and gone on some moon.
AG charged down his weapon, replaced it in its holster, and turned away.
Sleep on that, he said, and left them.
Mattis experienced a moment of disbelief. He just told Kost that Deck and Sari would return for them. Against his will, he let out a whimper. But AG, the new AG, had no reason to lie. He probably couldn't lie.
it would go against his programming, which meant that his friends were gone. Gone forever. And he was stuck there. Stuck forever. In the thick silence of the cell, he suddenly heard the scratching. Scratch, scratch, scratch. Faint at first, then bolder and unmistakable. Scratching in the walls. Soon they would be laughing, too. After a few days of trudging between their cell and the fold, Mattis and Lorica were put on construction duties. In that time, neither Wanton nor Ingo nor any First Order personnel approached them for information about the resistance. They seemed to just be prisoners now, like any of the others. Lorica sensed in Mattis an acceptance of his fate. She didn't like that the fight had gone out of him. When the fight is lost, the fight is lost, she recalled reading in a history book about war. She carried that sentence with her. You had to stay angry. You had to hold on to the fight. If you didn't, where could you get the energy to go on? Talking about feelings wasn't Lorica's strong suit. Having them and tapping into them in others was. So when she noticed the change in Mattis, she tried to draw him out. One morning, she thought it was morning anyway, since the haze that surrounded their cell was a lighter gray than it was when they slept, Mattis was just staring at the corner of the room.
What are you doing, Mattis? She asked, trying to speak in her gentlest voice.
He had been jumpy lately, like Kost had been when they'd first arrived. At first, he said nothing. She wasn't even sure if he'd heard her. But then he tilted his face to her, and she saw what he must have looked like when he was a little boy.
The scratching in the walls, he whispered.
Mattis, that's not real. Mattis shook his head. He appeared as if he hadn't slept in days. I guess the good news is that when I go totally crazy, I won't have to worry about going crazy. Lorica laughed.
That's a bad joke, she said.
Yeah, Mattis said. The color didn't return to his cheeks, but something in his eyes made him look like his old, annoying, upbeat self, if only for an instant. It's a bad joke, he agreed. But it's a good truth.
Mattis, you're not going crazy.
I'm definitely not going sane, though. He was keeping some version of a sense of humor, she thought, so that was a good sign. He wasn't all the way gone. She tried to keep him talking, asking him for stories about their brief time in the Resistance, something she knew he'd like to think about, and the good things about growing up on Dirk Teal. He responded, but every few minutes he'd sink back into that vacant hopelessness. At a certain point, Lorica abandoned the idea of letting Mattis share and just filled the room with words. One day, when his gloom got to be too much altogether, she told him,
"Snap out of it!"
"There's nothing to snap out of," he replied. She smacked him on the back of his head. They were slogging through the fold on their way to the far side of the throne room to repair the hole that had been put there by the First Order when they had initially arrived. It was their second day on the detail, and Mattis was terrible at it. Lorica had done the work of both of them, really. She'd made sure that the other prisoners who worked beside them didn't see just how small a load Mattis could carry with his skinny arms. She'd made sure that she did his work so the guards wouldn't notice his pathetic effort. At the end of the day, Lorica had been spent and aching. "No physical contact," the stormtrooper escorting them barked. Lorica could see that he just wanted something to yell at them about.
"I can't do this forever," Lorica told Mattis.
"Too bad," he mumbled. "This is what we do now."
"Mattis, I mean it."
"So do I." He tripped over a stone and she caught him. The stormtrooper was on them in a moment, yanking them apart.
"He tripped,"
Lorica complained.
"Don't care,"
the stormtrooper informed her.
"I'm okay," Mattis said, shaking it off.
"Also, don't care," the stormtrooper said. "Keep walking." They did, with their guard half a step behind them.
"Mattis, I'm not going to carry your load today," Lorica said. "I can't."
Mattis shrugged.
"Okay."
She sighed impatiently and shook her head. Mattis was beyond help. He was resigned to remaining in the detention center for the rest of his life. Well, Lorica wasn't. She'd carry on with her plan. In a few days, she'd made some progress with Ingo. It was nothing like the moment they'd shared that first night when he'd given her the rations packet, but his demeanor softened when he was in her presence.
Whatever it was that Lorica possessed, whatever ability her Zeltron blood gave her, it appeared to work. There was even a marked difference in the way Ingo stood from when he first approached their cell to when Lorica came closer to him. She could see his shoulders fall a little less square, the set of his chin become a little less harsh. For now, that small effect was enough. She would keep at it. She was certain she could get him to release them. For now, she had to carry on. She'd let Mattis wallow, if that was what he needed to do, but she wouldn't encourage it, and she wouldn't cover for him. That would only get her into trouble. She needed to avoid angering her keepers. That was the only way to succeed. That was the only way to survive. When they arrived at the far throne room wall, Lorica took a moment to retie her boots while Mattis stared gloomily into the sky. She remained resolute. She wouldn't help him again. While the other prisoners, the Gamorrean who'd been part of Hara the Hutt's coterie, a Powan with a large scar across his high forehead, a Flan with his timbered heart exposed, retrieved their tools and deliberately got to work, Mattis shuffled around in small circles. He kicked at plants and bugs and rocks and things and didn't do much to make himself look busy. He clearly didn't care. Lorica knew that Mattis figured it made no difference if he worked on repairing the wall or didn't. He was still stuck there. A couple of their stormtrooper guards put their helmets together and talked quietly, motioning to Mattis. He couldn't be bothered to change what he was doing, so he just kicked another rock down the hill behind him to the pile of bigger rocks that was down there. It made a satisfying knocking sound when it landed. "Hey, prisoner," one of the two stormtroopers hailed him. Mattis didn't stop his shuffling rotation, so the stormtrooper, annoyed, had to go over to where he was. He put a hard armored hand on Mattis's shoulder to stop.